TUC Radio, Time of Useful Consciousness. Professor Jim White, How to Respond to Climate Change Deniers. When the Weather and Climate Summit was established in 1985, the goal was to bring together weathercasters and meteorologists from the US and Canada with scientists and researchers. Their annual summit of 2017 was held in Breckenridge, Colorado, from January 8 to 12. One of the many topics at the summit was to prepare for the incoming Trump administration that includes outspoken climate change deniers. Dr. Jim White teaches at the University of Colorado. He specializes in global change, paleoclimate dynamics, and the human impact on climate. In a very entertaining and easy-to-understand way, he addressed the five topics climate change deniers most often bring up. How can we insignificant humans change the climate? How can something like CO2 that is in such low concentrations have such an impact? And by the way, isn't CO2 good for plants? We've seen about 1 degree of warming. Why worry about such a small change? I heard there was no warming recently for several years. Does that prove climate change isn't happening? Dr. Jim White began with the question, are we going to make the world uninhabitable for humans and other species? Here is Dr. Jim White, Director of the Institute for Arctic and Alpine Research at the University of Colorado.
Welcome, everybody. I would like to begin with a little exercise that I've been doing. I give public lectures about the topics of sustainability and resilience and climate change, etc., at least a couple of times a month. And I started to give a little demonstration I thought I'd share with you. It goes like this. And I do this for a while. And so what I'm doing here is I'm demonstrating for you the two primary types of behavior. One of them is, we understand is physics, right? So every time I drop this, this pen's going to fall, right? And I can drop this pen all day, every day, for the rest of my life, and it will fall every time. It will never stop in mid-fall and just hang up. And the reason for that has to do with the fact that the universe, as we understand it, is governed by physical laws, and those physical laws are not breakable. Right? So gravity is something that happens, and it happens all the time. And as scientists, we understand that. The other behavior that I'm demonstrating here is free will. I can stop doing this whenever I want. I can stop being annoying whenever I want. I choose... I am choosing not to do that.
Anytime, Jim. Anytime.
Anytime, anytime.
All right, I'll talk.
I do an entire lecture on this. We get confused about this sometimes. We get confused about those things that we can control, like free will, like stopping this pen dropping exercise, and those things that we cannot control. So we cannot, for example, control gravity. We cannot control the fact that molecules vibrate, and if molecules vibrate and you give them the right energy, they'll absorb that energy. And of course, I'm talking about, you know, greenhouse gases absorbing energy in the atmosphere. That's going to happen regardless of what we do, regardless of what we say, regardless of what we believe, regardless of what we would like to see happen. And that's an important distinction. Many people who don't understand science get those things confused. They get them mixed up. What are the things that I can believe in that I can actually have free will about? And what are those things that I really don't even get an opportunity to believe in? Because they're going to happen whether I believe in them or not. Okay. Anyway, I'm going to continue on. I've given many lectures here at this conference. So this year I thought I would frame my conversation around the top five questions I get asked at public talks. Right? And they are, Number one, are we going to make the world uninhabitable for humans and other species? I get this question a lot. How can we insignificant humans change the entire planet's climate? Another question I get asked quite frequently. Number three, how can something like CO2 that is in such low concentration have such an impact? And by the way, isn't CO2 good for plants? Number four, we've seen about a degree of warming. Why worry about such a small change? In other words, is 1 degree something that we should care about as inhabitants of the planet? And number five, and we've heard this frequently recently, I've heard that there's been no warming for several years. Does that prove that climate change is not happening? All right, I'll take you through these. Are we going to make the world uninhabitable for humans and other species? The short answer here is no. We're not pushing the climate system out of the bounds that have been observed in the past when life was present on the planet. Now, the better answer here is more nuanced, and it's more nuanced because climate has changed quite a bit on the planet over the years while life has been present, but not all life. And I'm talking now about species extinctions. So species have gone extinct frequently on the planet, and many of those extinctions we know are related to climate change, and particularly rapid climate changes. Going back about 40 million years ago, the planet was about 4 degrees warmer. CO2 levels, by the way, so CO2 is a hard thing to reconstruct that far back in the past. The ice core record, which goes back about 1 million years, can give us direct parcels of the atmosphere that we can measure CO2 in. But once we get beyond that time, then we're into a variety of things here. You see how many stomata are on leaves, phytoplankton, paleosols, liverworts, believe it or not, boron isotopes, things like that. And so you see, we think that the CO2 levels as you go back in the past were in the neighborhood of 500 to 1,000 parts per million if you get far enough back in time. All right? So this is another important lesson. We have enough carbon locked up in coal, oil, and natural gas to raise CO2 levels to at least 1,000 ppm. But that's not a level that the planet has never seen. Right? That's a level the planet has seen before. Right? Now, this is where the nuanced answer comes in. There have been major extinctions on the planet, the end of the Cretaceous, the end of the Triassic, the end of the Permian. Now, these are mass extinctions. There are as many as 30, 40, 50% of all species going extinct in a relatively short period of time. Currently, we're in an extinction. This is primarily driven today not by climate change, but by the fact that we are changing the surface of the planet. We are taking away habitat by building towns and villages and shopping malls and everything else that we build. We fragment migrational pathways. We do things to species that make it difficult for them to exist. Some species are going extinct because of climate change today, particularly those that are at the more sensitive zones. So high altitude species, Arctic species, where their habitats are changing quite a bit, are the species that we're seeing today that are being forced into extinction by a changing climate system. So, are we going to make the world uninhabitable for humans and other species? The better answer is no and yes. Climate change is a poor way to wipe out all life. And if you wanted to figure out how to wipe out all life, we can talk about that. There are ways to do it. We have the tools and the techniques. But yes, we are eliminating habitat and forcing species into extinction. And yes, climate change, especially large abrupt climate change, causes extinctions. It's important to recognize that in changing the energy in the climate system, we are indeed causing some species to go extinct, and we will cause more and more of them to go extinct, and that is not a good way to hang into the planet. All right, question number two. How can we insignificant humans change the planet's climate? And the answer to this one is even more important, and that is that we are not insignificant. This is a misconception that some people have. We, as a matter of fact, in one short generation, our generation, we went from really kind of a passenger on spaceship Earth, if you will. If you go back to the 1960s, as we used to tell us, we're passengers on spaceship Earth. We're no longer passengers. We're in the driver's seat. We're not only in the driver's seat, but we shoved a lot of the other people off the bus. We move 10 times more dirt than all natural erosive processes. If you add up all the dirt that flows through all the rivers and streams and blows through the atmosphere as dust every year, and you get a big number, and then you compare that to the amount of dirt we move in mining operations alone, it's 10 times more. Right? You can do this. You can go on Google Maps and you can look at coal mines in the western United States. You can find coal mines in Wyoming that you can easily see from outer space. Right? So these are very large holes in the ground. We've talked about this before also in the past. We make more nitrogen fertilizer than all bacteria on land. If you want to have life on a planet, you need to have, particularly the kind of life that we have, you need to have photosynthesis. And photosynthesis requires sunlight, it requires CO2, it requires water, and it requires nutrients. And those nutrients are generally nitrogen and phosphorus, but some smaller nutrients as well. So we really couldn't have plant life until we had nitrogen nutrients. And nitrogen nutrients are produced by bacteria. Bacteria take nitrogen out of the atmosphere, and as part of their energy strategy to survive, one of their waste products is ammonia or nitrate. And ammonia, nitrate, are water-soluble forms of nitrogen, which then plants can take up and build DNA and other molecules that we have in our bodies and that plants have in their tissues and that we need those things. So life on this planet really couldn't exist without those bacteria. We figured out in the 1930s how to take nitrogen out of the atmosphere, because it's very abundant, and make it into nitrate and ammonia. And today, we make more nitrate and ammonia than all the bacteria on land, which is pretty freaking remarkable thing to say, because in really one short generation, we went from not being part of one of the key systems on the planet to where we dominate that key system. And we have to. I mean, we could talk about more about this, but if we're going to feed 7 billion people, we've got to make nitrogen nutrients, because that's the way our agricultural systems function. We have to do that. And the scale with which we do that is the point I'm trying to make here. It's a recent development. This is population going back to about 10,000 years ago to today. It doesn't really show up as a large number until about 2,000 years ago. We're at 7.4 billion people today. It took about for when we started as a species to the early 1800s to get that first billion. It took about 120 years to get the second billion, then 33 years, and then 14 years and 13 years. And that's the exponential is a remarkable thing. Population demographers told us this was coming, but we really didn't digest this very well in terms of planning for the future. Another example of an impressive human-caused change that's already occurring and has occurred for quite some time now is something called dead zones. So I talked to you about all these nitrogen nutrients. When we fertilize our farmlands, some of these excess nutrients run down the rivers. They go into the estuaries and then out into the, in this case, the Gulf of Mexico, or they go in the Atlantic, etc. And those excess nutrients cause phytoplankton to like go crazy. They love this stuff. It's like, you know, buffet is on. It's like, all right, time to eat. They eat like crazy, and then they die. When they die, their body parts have to decay, and when they decay, they suck all the oxygen out of the water. And so you end up at this water that cannot support oxygen-needing life. And this has been happening for a long time. There's huge swaths of the Gulf of Mexico, huge swaths of the Atlantic coast as well, that nothing lives in, at least for part of the year. And because it's water, as you know, it's moving around, and so that dead zone moves around and kills off a few things and other things move in. But the fact that we can do that is another example of how human beings are really not insignificant on the planet. Right? Water, we use pretty much all the available surface water in developed countries. So in Europe and in the United States, in many years in the United States, we use 100% of the available surface fresh water. And as you know, it gets used over and over again. We also pump groundwater in order to get through droughts. And we're learning that groundwater supplies are depleting very rapidly. And so there's a day of reckoning coming there. And again, if you think about it, all right, is a small species capable of pumping groundwater to the point where you're exhausting it in many parts of the world? No. I mean, this is clearly a species that has a huge impact. All right, so the bottom line is we're not insignificant with respect to the planet's capacity to support us. To think otherwise will delay action that is needed to achieve sustainable, resilient human societies. This ought to be a T-shirt in much, much fewer words, but it ought to be a T-shirt. Okay, number three. How can something like CO2 that is in such low concentration have such an impact? And by the way, isn't CO2 good for plants? Right? Shorter answer is that things that come in small sizes have big impacts. Right? We know this. Right? If you look at the radiative balance of the planet on the large scale, the Earth's temperature without greenhouse gases, without these small amounts of gases in the atmosphere, would be about negative 18 degrees C. We know this. We have satellites at the top of the atmosphere that tell us this is how much solar energy we're getting. And if we were just a rock in outer space with no atmosphere, we would be about negative 18 degrees C on average. And most people would argue that's too cold for advanced life. We couldn't exist as we are on the planet. Now, the Earth's temperature with thermometers taken out there is about 15 degrees. And the difference between negative 18 and plus 15, about 33 degrees C, is the impact of these very small amounts of gases that are in the atmosphere, these greenhouse gases. They raise the temperature of the planet by a large amount. Okay, and that's a good thing. Right? So if we didn't have greenhouse, we need to recognize that. If we didn't have greenhouse gases, we would not be a liquid planet. We would be a frozen planet. So when I get this question about how can something that's 400 parts per million make a difference, we'll talk about water. All right? So water, the average percentage of water vapor in the atmosphere over the U.S. is about 1%. You've got crops. You've got plants. You've got precipitation. You've got, you know, wonderful, lovely green things that exist because of 1%. Right? Again, when I get that question, how can something at 400 parts per million make a big difference? Well, how can something at 1% totally change the surface of North America? And the answer is small things have big impacts. Right? Isn't CO2 good for plants? And the answer is yes. As I pointed out before, plants need CO2, they need sunlight, they need water, and they need nutrients to grow. All right. So, if you give plants more of any of those things, will they do better? And the answer is generally yes. Biologists tell us there are limiting factors. So, for example, if there's no nitrogen available, it doesn't matter how much water you give a plant, it's going to die. Right. So, but if there's enough of these things around and you add more, then you're going to get a boost in plant growth. So imagine the sun was heating up, for example. We had a much hotter sun, giving the plants many, many more photons to do photosynthesis. Would they grow more? The answer is likely yes. Right? We can do that. You can take plants into a greenhouse and give them artificial sunlight, and they'll do better. Now, would it become unbearably hot? And the answer is yes, it would become unbearably hot. Right? The important thing to recognize here is that, you know, good things always in moderation. And we hear this quite a bit. This is Jeff Sessions here. Carbon pollution is CO2, and that's not really a pollutant. That's plant food, yes. And it doesn't harm anybody, except it might include a little temperature increase, yes. Does it really harm anybody? Yeah, as a matter of fact, yeah. So again, good things in moderation. Now, plants are growing more. All right? This is one of the more remarkable observations that we have today. Here you see the sources of carbon from 2006 to 2015. It's 91% from fossil fuels, 9% from deforestation. And on the right is a partitioning of where that stuff is gone. And this is one of the things that I do in my research. I use carbon isotopes and other things to try to figure out. We know how much stayed in the atmosphere. We can measure that. How much of that went into land plants versus how much goes into the ocean, we can actually figure that partitioning out using something called carbon 13. But from 2006 to 2015, about 31% of the carbon that we put in the atmosphere is now in land plants. It has increased the amount of land biomass that's out there. About 26% of it dissolved in the ocean. And the ocean would like to run the show, and so the ocean is going to take in some of that. And about 44% of it's still in the atmosphere. All right. So is CO2 plant food? Yes. Have plants been growing more? Yes. All right. Despite deforestation, there is more biomass on the planet today than there was in the 1800s, which is pretty remarkable. Because if you follow deforestation, we are deforesting today, and we have deforested since we started out as a species, and there's definitely less large forests, particularly in tropical areas today, than there has been at any time because of us. Now, it's important to recognize that we can't grow our way out of the increase of CO2 in the atmosphere. And the reason I can say that with confidence is that there is way more carbon in coal, oil, and natural gas than there is in all living biomass on the planet. All right, so if we wanted to grow plants to remove all carbon dioxide, we would have to have not only this planet, but we're going to have to rent two or three other planets in order to make that happen. We simply don't have enough biomass. We don't have enough land surface. And at the same time, we also compete with land plants for the land surface. We need land surface to grow crops. And that means you don't have space for trees to grow that you would have otherwise. And so, no, you can't grow your way out of this. Okay, number four. We've seen about 1 degree C of warming. Why worry about such a small change? And this is one of the more important questions, I think. And I really like it when I get this question. I think it shows that people are thinking about this. You know, 1 degree, is that really significant? Is that really important? All right, so let's take a look at what 1 degree means. So we think that during the various interglacial periods that existed, about 120,000, 140,000, 240,000, et cetera, roughly every 100,000 years in the past, we think it was warmer during many of those, including the last one. And we have fairly good records accessing the last interglacial period. We think it was about 2 degrees C warmer at that time. Okay. Now that's helpful because I'll loop back and I'll show you what are some of the key metrics in terms of how the planet looked with 2 degrees of warming. I would point out, by the way, so 2 degrees is not a number that I'm just pulling out of my head. 2 degrees is what, you know, right now the global leaders are arguing over whether or not we can achieve a plateau at 2 degrees. And some people are saying, no, it's got to be 1.5. So 2 is an important number here. If you go back about 3 to 5 million years ago, you'll find the planet was warmer at that time by about 2 degrees. This is fairly well documented. This is ocean bugs that live out there that record temperature. And 5 million years is quite accessible in the ocean sediment record. So we're pretty confident that if you go back 4 or 5 million years ago, you get temperatures about 2 degrees warmer. By the way, 3 to 5 million years ago, CO2 levels were about 400 parts per million. If you go back farther in time, you'll find that if you go back about 40 million years, the planet was about 4 degrees warmer than today. That's a significant point in Earth's history because Antarctica started roughly at that point in time. So if you go back about 40 million years, and that's when the planet cooled off enough that Antarctica started. So is 2 degrees significant? And the short answer is yes. Right? It was about 2 degrees warmer in the last interglacial period. Sea level was about 5 meters higher at that point. 5 meters higher at 2 degrees. That was about 1,000 years of warmer time. Right? So keep in mind that it takes a while to melt ice, and we'll talk about that in a minute. It was about 4 degrees warmer when the Antarctic ice sheet did not exist, and sea level was about 80 meters higher at that point. So there's about, between Antarctica and Greenland, there's about 80 meters of sea level that's been taken out of the ocean and put down as land ice in Antarctica and Greenland. And that's an important lesson for, again, you know, those of us who look at deep Earth's history, this is like no big deal. Yeah, constantly we have sea level rising or falling and land ice doing the opposite. That's just the way the planet functions. But for many people, the idea that sea level could be 80 meters higher, you know, when you actually look at the maps, it's like this is one of those holy shit moments. In the last 40 million years, the full range of temperature change has been about 10 degrees C. That includes no ice sheets, and that includes large glaciations. Right. So no, 2 is not insignificant. 2 is a decent part of 10. Right. If you take away the glacial side of that, which is about 6 degrees, it got 6 degrees colder during the last glacial period. The warming that we've seen over the last 40 million years was about 4 degrees. And we saw huge changes on the surface of the planet that accompanied that 4 degrees. So no, 2 degrees is not insignificant, and 1 degree is not insignificant. I've heard there's been no warming for several years. Does that prove climate change is not happening? No. Physics still applies, right? Global climate depends on 3 factors. We know this. How much energy we get from the sun, that's physics. How much of that energy is reflected back to outer space by the white bits, physics. And the amount of greenhouse gas, which is controlled by molecular vibrations, again, physics. Right. So if you increase the amount of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere, you will change the amount of energy in the atmosphere, and you will change, therefore, the climate on the planet, because the climate on the planet is indeed the energy in the atmosphere. Our focus tends to be on air temperatures, because we live in the atmosphere. The ocean community thinks we're pretty, you know, selfish, and you know, the fish out there, you know, they get together occasionally and say bad things about us. But the fact is, you know, 90-something percent of the heat capacity at the surface of the Earth is in the oceans. Ocean heat content has been increasing. And the reason for that is that as you accumulate greenhouse gases in the atmosphere, you accumulate energy in the atmosphere. As you accumulate energy in the atmosphere, it has to go someplace. And it can go to evaporation. It can go to temperature. If it's going to go to temperature, it's going to warm the ocean up. And if we got a good accounting of how the ocean is behaving, you'll see that this keeps going up over time. So the atmosphere temperature is really the tail. It's the ocean that's the dog. And we need to pay attention to the ocean. And you can see on there, yes, indeed, the atmospheric temperatures slowed down their growth. And that's what you expect. You expect that on a planet that is 70% ocean. When you have times in which cold water circulating up to the surface, it air conditions the atmosphere. When you have times when deep ocean is not being allowed up to the surface, the surface ocean warms up very quickly, and you end up with a much warmer planet. This is what a phenomenon of El Nino and La Nina. All right? So we know this. There will be times when atmospheric temperatures bounce around a little bit, but they are the 7-8% of the heat capacity. If you really want to understand what the planet is doing, you need to understand the ocean. Part of the message of change is that it takes a generation or two for, you know, what we put in the atmosphere to have its full impact on the planet, because it takes a while to warm up the ocean. We argue about when did the Anthropocene start? When did human beings really reach a point where they were the number one thing on the planet? It's really in the 1980s where the amount of greenhouse gas in the atmosphere really begins to shoot up. The warming, particularly that followed that time, we can't attribute to anything but the increase in greenhouse gases, which are a human-caused thing.
That was Dr. Jim White, Director of the Institute for Arctic and Alpine Research at the University of Colorado. He spoke at the annual conference of the Weather and Climate Summit before meteorologists and TV and radio weathercasters. They met in Breckenridge, Colorado, from January 8 to 12, 2017. Dr. White was preparing the audience, and now you as well, for challenges by climate change deniers. You can hear this program again for free on TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. Look for the newest programs page. TUC Radio is free and depends on the support of listeners like you. Your donation keeps this program on the air. Go to TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. There you can also subscribe to weekly free podcasts. Time of useful consciousness is an aeronautical term. It's the time between the beginning of oxygen deficiency and the loss of consciousness. Time for useful projects to rescue the planet and the plane. My name is Maria Glöden. Thank you for listening.